Welcome. You are listening to a recording provided for the use of those who are blind and or print impaired. Materials or items read on ARSLA and the Los Angeles Radio Reading Service are the copyrighted property of the original authors and publishers. No unauthorized use or duplication is permitted. Welcome to episode 333 of Green and Growing in the Garden, the weekly gardening show developed and designed for the Los Angeles Radio Reading Service. I'm Hugh Ralston, your host and producer, and I look forward to sharing with you over the next 40 minutes updates to our local garden scenes and recent articles about gardens, plants, and designers, both in California and around the world. Gardens are in my DNA. I was raised in a family of gardeners, and my grandparents and mother handed down a love of flowers, of orchids, and of roses, among many other gifts. I have been an inveterate gardener for years, from that first six-pack of marigolds I bought at Home Depot in suburban Connecticut to laying out birthday rose gardens, planting fruit trees, and rescuing overgrown and underloved gardens, as well as building my own garden library with classic design texts, memoirs, and commentaries from gardeners and designers alike, and, well, just a few glossy coffee table indulgences. I've spent years getting to know California's Mediterranean garden landscapes, plants, and climate. Even as I have fallen for English and continental garden design traditions, grown fond of the particularities and peculiarities of succulents, which perform so well in our climate, and learned to love and respect the quiet power of a Japanese garden. I've been active in local garden societies and visited botanical gardens across the country and around the world, believing not only in the benefits of gardening itself, but of being in the garden, and of being charmed by that special alchemy of plants, climate, soil, design, place, space, light, and shade. Gardens are a place where we can become more alive and more connected with the world we share with others. And, as the good book reminds us, it all began in a garden. Welcome to this week's show. It's the beginning of March, and we would normally share the Southern California garden event calendar, but it's unclear yet how the Los Angeles Times is going to respond to and carry on following the death of its key plants reporter, Jeanette Marantos, who died last month. So this week, we're going to focus on several articles gleaned over the last couple of years on vegetables. The first is an article by Jonathan Moulis, published on November 8, 2025. The Michelin Pedigree Chef Breaking the Kitchen Garden Rules. The Clove Club's Isaac McHale was keen to spice up his menu with heritage and exotic veg, so he found a plot of land and started planting. In a small kitchen garden in London on the autumn harvest day, Chef Isaac McHale thrust a copy of a paperback by Christopher Stocks from 2009 called Forgotten Fruits, The Stories Behind Britain's Traditional Fruit and Vegetables, into my hands. This book was part of my journey into discovering more of the fantastic old varieties of fruit and vegetables that Britain has to offer, and helped crystallize my hopes of running our own market garden for the restaurant into something I knew I really wanted to do, he says. That garden has been erected on the edge of an East London school playground, where students can watch 45-year-old McHale, who was born in Orkney and raised in Glasgow, grow from seed a variety of vegetables and fruits for his two Michelin-starred Shoreditch restaurant, the Clove Club. For McHale, being able to grow produce and have a connection to it was integral to the experience he wanted to create at his restaurant, following in the footsteps of establishments such as Manresa in California, Alain Passard's L'Arpège in Paris, Mugaritz in Errenteria, Le Manoir aux Quatre Saisons. I visit on a harvest day. We walk through the school campus to the one-acre site, about the size of a football field, where the growing happens. That seems like a large amount of land, but the Royal Docks Academy has plenty of outdoor space. I count five actual football pitches, as well as open land with benches on for the students to use for sports and recreation. So the growing space feels a lot less invasive. As we cross the rows of plantings, McHale invites me to taste Christian yellow chilies, pink brandywine tomatoes, and tagetes leaves, which are grown in a polytunnel alongside thick, fleshy Costoluto Fiorentino tomatoes and Petite Cherry Chadwick tomatoes, Carollo chilies and Tonda di Chioggia beetroot. These are things I often couldn't put into the menu in the past because we got so little of them from suppliers, he says. Next to these towering plants sit rows of chili varieties in what grower Hugo Silva describes as planting pits. It is noticeably warmer inside the polytunnel than the early autumn temperature outside, which is why there are still tomatoes ripening on the vines around us. This isn't about replacing the basic onions and carrots, which we get from New Covent Garden. This is about growing specialist things, says Mikhail, who is preparing to plant seeds gifted from other chefs and restaurants, including Jorge Vallejo in Mexico City and Dan Barber of Row 7 Seed Company in New York. It's expensive in comparison, but worth it if we can reduce the amount of fruit and veg we buy from overseas suppliers. It's about seasonality, he continues, but the pit allows us a little bit more time to let those beans and tomatoes just go a little bit longer because they need to be cozy and warm. The project is backed by the local authority, Newham, and built in partnership with Organic Leah, a workers' cooperative based in an acre of once derelict allotment land in the northeast fringes of London. They were put in touch with the school by Patrick Vickers, a self-described food activist and founder of Regenerous, which works with councils and schools to set up food growing spaces. Vickers waxes lyrical about the symbiotic relationship between chefs like McHale and schools trying to teach about healthy eating on limited funds, but admits it was not easy to find an appropriate site. The Royal Docks Academy, which has provided the land, has quite substantial green space, but I am guessing the children who spill out during break time have had little contact with nature in their home life, given the lack of parks nearby and the concrete shopping arcades and blocks of flats abutting the campus. I have been to 50 or 60 schools, and 6 or 7 have a surprising amount of green space, but the rest are concrete jungles, Vickers says. A second polytunnel has been erected on the plot for the school to grow their own produce, complete with ramps to assist students in wheelchairs, though when I visit, this is still a work in progress. McHale pays about £30,000 a year to cover Silva's salary part-time, plus a second seasonal grower for the busy summer months, seeds, tools, and a contingency fund, as well as the cost of a weekly food delivery to the Clove Club. The land is provided rent-free by Newham. Mikhail pulls out a chickpea pod for me to taste the contents, fresh from the plant, brimming with pride. I don't know anywhere else in the UK that grows chickpeas like that, he says. Cucumbers are another plant that grows for longer in the season, thanks to the polytunnel's warmth. Mikhail picks one off its vine, making sure to retain the leafy yellow flower attached at its tip. That's kind of a catnip for chefs, he says. Back at the Clove Club, based in the grand rooms of the Grade 2 listed Shoreditch Town Hall, McHale's team will use the tomatoes in a beetroot gazpacho granita, served as a palate cleanser. We use the tagetes leaves, Mexican marigold, to garnish this dish, he adds. Earlier tomato harvests have gone to the Clove Club's sister venue, Bar Valette, where chef Stan Roblicki used them to make tomato tonnato and a peach and tomato salad. The courgettes and patty pan squash we used in the summer with lobster to make courgette puree. And for pieces on the plate, the aubergines we have used to make organic aubergine with green tomato juice, lemon verbena, and Saint Nectaire cheese, McHale explains. Right now, we're making a dish with steamed Cornish mackerel and a little stew of shell beans and fresh chickpeas from the garden, alongside broad bean leaves and pea shoots. The kitchen garden was only started in April, so McHale has not been able to capitalize on a full growing season, but he describes it as a great start, as well as an education. The garden forces you, as a chef, to change your mindset. The garden leads you. You need to work with what it gives you and preserve when you have a glut. An article by Jonathan Moulis, published on November 8, 2025 in the Financial Times of London, The Michelin Pedigree Chef Breaking the Kitchen Garden Rules. Our next two articles, both by our good friend Robin Lane Fox, published in the Financial Times of London, focus on more established and royally connected kitchen gardens. The first, published on July 18, 2025, Succulent Lessons from Versailles' 17th Century Kitchen Garden, a reimagining of Louis XIV's potager, a historic hotbed of planting and pruning know-how, gleans tips for the modern age. Clever vegetable gardens pack ever more into ever smaller spaces. Scaling Down suits modern scaled-down gardens. I have recently visited a stunning example going against the trend and scaling up. At Versailles in 1678, Louis XIV commissioned a royal vegetable garden of 23 acres, the Potager du Roi, which still survives. It is ignored or underappreciated by most of the visitors to Versailles' enormous park and palace. It is fascinating. At 10 Rue de Maréchal Joffre, in the bookshop at the Potager's entrance, I met my historical helpers, Mathilde Auger, directrice of the World Monument Fund in Paris, and Meredith Wiggins, an environmental researcher and archaeologist with the fund. Beyond us, in glaring sunshine, stretched dozens of splayed fruit trees, formal beds, and vegetables edged by scorched grass paths and hard-worn surfacing. The WMF expert stepped out and gave me an outline of the garden's history. As his court at Versailles grew, Louis XIV wanted a huge potager to provide fruit, vegetables, herbs, and flowers for the royal table. He insisted on a site near his palace and picked one known as the Stinking Pond. For 5 years, from 1678 to 1683, workers drained the swamp and laid out a formal garden. As the existing soil was so poor, they carted in fresh soil from a faraway hill. At Versailles, the main landscape gardens and waterworks are masterpieces by André Le Nôtre, a genius known to everyone interested in garden history. Le Nôtre did not design or supervise the king's vegetable garden, where the grand central court had 16 square beds and another 29 interrelated gardens. It was the masterpiece of another hero, underappreciated in English histories of gardening. I'm not referring to Sabine de Barras, the fictional gardener who was played by Kate Winslet in that excruciatingly unhistorical film, A Little Chaos, released in 2014. De Barras presented as impressing Le Nôtre, and then the king himself with her love of roses and her own informal style of gardening in her little backyard. The result ranks high on my list of unmissable, silly films, with de Barras designing a bosquet or clipped grove with fountains for the king's delight, whereas in real life the potager was designed, planted, and supervised by master gardener Jean-Baptiste de la Quintinie. I bow to him across the centuries. Before my visit, I knew de la Quintinie for his book on the cultivation of fruit and vegetables, published posthumously in 1690. I assumed he was just a specialist in training French fruit trees into virtuoso shapes like clipped green poodles. But he was far more than that. As a cultivator, innovator, and organizer, he towers above us. He writes of how he tried 100 varieties of melon before deciding on the best two. As figs were a special love of the king, he planted 700 fig trees and trained them to produce ripe fruits. One of the best was called Angelique. He calibrated the differing qualities of animal manures. He manipulated the seasons of fruit and vegetables by planting them in sunny or shady aspects, ingeniously contrived. He produced strawberries in late March, green peas, a new fashion at court, in April, and asparagus in December. Aptly, a bronze statue of him with a branch of a fruit tree in one hand looks over the huge potager he devised and ran with a team of 30 gardeners. It is amazing that his ground plan is still visible. Nearly 340 years have passed since his death, a period full of royal, then revolutionary French history. The garden is about to leap forward again, as the World Monuments Fund is backing a major upgrade and phased restoration. In the early 1990s, so Auger and Wiggins explain, Hubert de Givenchy, then chair of the WMF, shared an evening walk in Versailles with Bunny Mellon, second wife of the oil magnate Paul. She was an avid gardener, a regular critic of my writings, corresponding from her home in Oak Springs, Virginia, and a generous supporter of items in garden history and practice. After a fine dinner in the chateau, Givenchy and Mellon strolled, as Louis XIV often did, down a sloping path to the royal gate, which blocks the entrance to the potager. Mellon was amazed by what then she saw inside, a revelation to her, as to me. Convinced that it needed to be preserved, she bestowed funds from the charitable foundation she had created in memory of her father, Gerard B. Lambert, and propelled a restoration of the gilded formal gate and the garden court's central fountain. Over Zoom, the potager head gardener, Yvonne Fay, and its director, Alexandra Bonnet, explained some of the changes and challenges they have had to confront. No garden stands still. De la Quintigny trained fruit trees in complex shapes against walls, but in open spaces he grew them only as bushes without any solid metal frames. He never grew box hedges either. Like metal frames, box hedging, I learnt, came into the potager only in the 19th century. It has yet to attract the box moth, which is ruining box leaves in gardens elsewhere. Fay directs a team which numbers 15 gardeners, helped by 50 volunteers. In summer, rhubarb, globe artichokes, and rows of potatoes cover broad areas between the low-trained espalier fruit trees. These trees' shoots look too vertical to me, but Thay explained that they were about to receive their summer pruning, a taille en verre. No mechanical clippers are used for it. Since 2010, pesticides and weed killers have been banned too. To control carrot fly, the gardeners plant garlic, a trick that never works in my garden. We discussed quinces, agreeing that they are robust trees in dry climates. We also discussed spinach, no good in dry summers, and green sorrel, whose lemony leaves are my top choice as a filling for an omelet. De la Quintigny grew three varieties of it. The WMF has just held an international conference on cultivating resilience in order to pool ideas for the management of historic gardens and landscapes in a hotter climate. Whether the moat around the Tower of London or a sacred grove in Nigeria, quinces and sorrel are suited to the new age. In 1782, Alexandre Brown, English by origin, was chosen to be the potager's head gardener. 7 years later, the revolution broke out, but like other royal monuments, the potager survived. It was rebranded as a garden for the Republic. In due course, it acquired a crucial role as a human seedbed. It became a training ground for pupils, now members of the Higher National School of Landscape Gardening beside the potager, of which Bonnet is also director. They learn to garden as well as to design. They even learn how to prune fruit trees into complex, formal shapes. Gardening is a skilled craft. Like others, it will die if it is not transmitted. I had no idea until a month ago of this school's existence, though it produces many of France's top public gardeners. In Britain, we have a Royal Horticultural Society and a king who is an apostle of organic practice in his garden at Highgrove. What we need is to unite them in a way that France cannot. We need a royal school in which to train skilled gardeners, heirs to De la Quintigny and his royal patron, who like to come and learn to garden in person. An article by Robin Lane Fox, published on July 18, 2025, in the Financial Times of London. Succulent lessons from Versailles' 17th century kitchen garden. Our second Robin Lane Fox column was published September 23rd, 2022. Q's kitchen garden is fit for an Echo King. It used to supply King George III. Now it uses sustainable methods the new monarch would approve of. Vegetable gardening is caught between two hard places. The summer's drought has been ruinous for lettuces, spinach, and leafy green crops. The cost of heating a greenhouse has soared, putting aubergine, peppers, cucumbers, and indoor tomatoes beyond easy reach. In June, Kew Gardens opened a new area called Edible Science, aiming to work towards more sustainable production processes. I have just checked it out. It stands on the site of Kew's old walled kitchen garden, which once supplied food to King George III. Our Echo King Charles III will appreciate its ground rules. It is following a no-dig policy. Like the King's Garden at Highgrove, it avoids use of chemical weed killers. It will soon include a shelter with an edible green roof of alpine strawberries, thyme, and nasturtiums, whose peppery leaves are good in salads. Bee houses, B-E-E, will be placed around the garden, and some of the cabbage plants will be left to run to seed so that Kew scientists can study their pollen. Some of the beds link up with existing research at Kew, whether on food plants in Mexico or the types of bean that will best resist drought. This edible science area is another fine addition to the garden, one visitors will enjoy inspecting. It stands near the recently planted Agius Evolution Garden, which shows the advance of plants on our planet through the millions of years since life began. Like the Evolution Garden, it is the result of generous donations. Its budget was £280,000 to include a new pattern of paths with a hard surfacing of sustainable SEDEC gravel. Like me, the planners consider that vegetables are best grown in beds raised above the level of whatever passes for existing soil. Beds with porous edging have been built up on top of it. As Kew has an abundance of homemade shredded compost, it was tractored round to the veg beds and laid to a depth of at least 1 foot above the old soil's level. The cost is way beyond normal gardeners' budgets, but the principle of raising beds and laying new soil is certainly not. At Kew, the capital budget has to cover the cost of gardeners to maintain the project. It has also paid for water points in the corner of each bed to which leaky hose pipes can be attached and run at ground level for an hour at a time. They are the most economical way of watering vegetables, especially in a garden which depends on one full-time gardener and volunteers. With Helena Dove, head of the kitchen garden, I looked at progress since work began 9 months ago. The visual impact of kitchen gardening is so quick. While my recently planted hellebores have been struggling to survive dry weather, Kew's edible garden has acquired vertical lines and a green and jungly look. Curtains of gourds and edible climbers hang on metal arches. I was impressed by wooden panels, each with 5 rows of slats, which are propped up at an angle above one of the beds like cold frames. They make supports about 3 feet long for scrambling cucumbers planted beneath. The Roman Emperor Tiberius used to order his cucumbers to be grown on movable frames, which could be sited wherever the sun was strongest early in the year. At Kew, the cucumbers are raised under glass, like many of the vegetables in the edible science garden, and are then transplanted beside these frames in early summer. On their slats, cucumber mini munch and Bedfordshire prize are growing happily. A good source of seeds for next year's crop is dtbrownseeds.co.uk, which even lists one called Socrates. How have the Echo rules worked out in practice? Dove explains to my group of fellow gardeners how she burns off existing weeds with a flame gun and never uses chemical weed killers. She's still picking off the stems of burnt bindweed by hand whenever they reappear. I would never be so dogmatic. One targeted dab of glyphosate on the leaves and all that bindweed would have been harmlessly dead long ago. Glyphosate kills by contact with leaves, not the soil. To stop weeds in the SEDEC paths, I bet that chemicals will have to be used anyway. Dove and her team also never dig the ground. The world, she tells me, has been doing fine without us. I am a veteran of a type of digging called bastard trenching. It depends what you want to do with the world meanwhile. Broadly, I agree with a no-dig policy. Digging disturbs the soil and encourages weeds to germinate in it. In establishing veg beds, I too would prefer to top-dress heavily with mulches after rain in winter and then hoe the surface lightly from time to time. However, deep mulches can't be piled on year after year. There needs to be an interval in which forking is an alternative. One of Dove's excellent aims is to illustrate what owners of smaller gardens can grow. She has 3 good maxims. Use vertical space, think in chunks of 1 square foot at a time, marked out by canes laid on the ground, choose heavily cropping smaller varieties. I noted down the labels on her low-growing tomatoes, Tumbling Tom Red and Tumbling Tom Yellow, and her low peppers, Lemon Dream and Tangerine Dream. I also learnt from her advice and example that the answer to growing proper spinach is to sow Malabar spinach under glass and set the young plants out in summer when they will make climbing plants with big green leaves, fully flavored. King's Seeds of Kelvedon Essex supply packets for only £2.05. Q's venture in edible science is keen to find edible vegetables that we are ignoring. I am not sure that the roots of ornamental cannas will ever dominate dinner tables. Yacon might perhaps have a future, but I will not give up on potatoes just because they have had a bad year of blight. Dahlia tubers may seem like another culinary dead end, but here I was updated by one of my fellow visitors. Lucy Hutchins abandoned a career in fashion and jewelry in order to be self-sufficient in vegetables, feeding herself and her family. Gardening in bone-dry Suffolk, she has more than 160,000 followers on Instagram at She Grows Veg, and tells me that she and her husband, a professional chef, grate some of the tubers of their dahlias when they lift them and then cook them as a tasty rösti. What about that eco-flashpoint wildlife? At Q, labels like to spell out experience for visitors. After hearing about cohabitating with slugs, I hit on the label of the day. I illustrate it with this column. We are currently experiencing lots of badger action. Join the gang, Q. Chili flakes and pepper will never deter a badger on the prowl. Stripey invaders are trotting through the garden's gate at night and rootling in its dampened Ethiopian beds. Watering encourages them to play ball with Dove's young vegetables in search of grubs and insects. I hate to mention it, Q, but badgers have a history of being edible too. And the sign that's posted is written out, "We are currently experiencing lots of badger action. They seem fond of this bed. We are working out how to deter them." A column by Robin Lane Fox, published on September 23rd, 2022, in the Financial Times of London, "Q's kitchen garden is fit for an eco-king." Our fourth story this week is by Tabby Jackson G. It was published on September 15th, 2023, in the Financial Times. How to grow your own orchard. They have benefits for people, pollinators, and the planet, which explains why efforts are underway to fight their decline. A decade ago, our walled garden was mostly orchard. But thanks to a predecessor with a preference for neatness and an easy garden, the rows of old, mossy, gnarled apple trees, which at this time of year would have been heavy with fruit, were ripped out and replaced with a lawn. One apple tree is all that's left of what was once a productive, beautiful, and quintessentially English scene. Many other orchards have met similar fates. A study by the People's Trust for Endangered Species found that 90% have been lost in England and Wales since the 1950s. With the main reason for this decline being cited as the lack of replacement tree planting, which is a problem not just for the aesthete and the cider lover, but for wildlife too. In 2007, they were classed as priority habitats by the UK's Biodiversity Action Plan, BAP. For an orchard to thrive, you need a lot of things to be on your side. You'll need to be lucky with the weather, have good soil and pollinators. You'll also need to be disease and pest-free, which is possible if your ecosystem is in balance. Traditional orchards are characterized by widely spaced, standard fruit trees. Often they'll consist of fruit varieties which are hard to procure elsewhere, in your local supermarket, for example. Grown on vigorous rootstocks and planted at low densities, orchards benefit from an understory of grassland or meadow. Orchards also lend themselves perfectly to the modern notion of food forests, where fruit trees form the top layer of planting, with other edible plants underneath them. Elsa Little is a Manchester project manager at The Orchard Project, a UK-based charity devoted to bringing orchards to urban environments. While urban orchards are not such a familiar sight in 2023, London was historically filled with orchards and fruit growers, especially in the east around the City of London. Little is trying to bring back the urban orchard to the benefit of people and pollinators. Not only do they provide food for humans, but they also serve as excellent habitats and feeding grounds for urban insects. She works with community groups in London, Glasgow, Swansea, Manchester, and Edinburgh to establish new orchards, and the project also runs training for pruning, aftercare, mulching, and tree health assessments. Little ascribes the loss of orchards in the UK to changes in land use as well as a lack of interest in them. Fruit trees are relatively short-lived, so there's not been enough replanting of the trees, and people haven't been managing them. But as far as community-driven urban planting goes, you can't really beat an orchard. Not only are they pleasant places to spend time in, they also require little in the way of maintenance, offer a rich home for pollinators, help with carbon sequestration, provide shade, and intercept rainfall. Even on a commercial scale, apple growing can bring climate and wildlife benefits. Cider apple grower Bob Wadey farms 42,000 trees on 167 acres in Somerset, producing 2,000 to 3,000 tons of apples a year that are sold to Showering's Cider. When the harvest finishes in mid-November, the acreage, which was previously a dairy farm belonging to Wadey's wife, is flooded with thousands of redwings, field fares, and big flocks of chaffinches and wood pigeons, all of whom come to feast on the 6 varieties of apples that his machine hasn't been able to collect. It's not an organic operation, but Wadey tries his best to avoid using chemicals and only does so under the advice and careful supervision of his agronomist. Making your own cider is just one way to deal with the huge glut of apples orchard owners find themselves with. It's also an opportunity to enjoy your personal terroir. The French word, which usually translates as a taste of place, has begun to be borrowed from viticulture by the British cider-making industry to help spark discussions around the topography, soil, and climate that affects apples as much as grapes. The southwest of England, especially, is famous for its fruit-friendly climate. And over on the edge of Dartmoor, Charles Stanlin has been helping his clients make the most of their orchards for much of his career. Stanlin, who at 71 has only recently taken on a younger apprentice, has worked with orchards for 40 years, but recently has noticed a resurgence in interest in them. Since COVID, lots of people have moved down and bought land and wanted to plant orchards, he says. I realize how much I know when I come across people who don't know very much. People plant orchards themselves and can make horrendous mistakes and waste lots of money. The biggest risks are overdoing the planting and not planting properly, especially in the east of the country where the winter tends to be wetter, Stanlin says. People put too much compost in and don't stake the trees properly, so they rub and think they can get away without deer protection. Roe deer can decimate an entire new orchard in one evening, and a lack of knowledge often leads people to plant the wrong varieties that are unsuitable to their growing conditions. Orchards, when done well, are incredible mosaic habitats, meaning that they have multiple different habitats in one place, with fruit trees, grassland, meadow, and potentially even woodland or areas of scrub nearby. They cater to all sorts of pollinators and small mammals, better yet if there is a pond nearby. Another wildlife-friendly attribute of an orchard is their inherent lack of soil disturbance. There is no need to dig around in an orchard, so life below ground is left to its own devices, perpetrated only by roots, animals, insects, and fungi. Fruit trees also start to decay while they're still alive and producing fruit. This wood decay is really important, says Little. An oak tree can live for 500 years. They're not going to start having features like tree hollows, rotten wood, and decaying wood for a really long time, whereas a fruit tree can start developing those after 20 years. This, explains Little, is part of the reason why orchards provide such an attractive habitat for so many species. One of the UK's native beetles, the noble chafer, is completely reliant on the decaying wood of fruit trees and therefore most often found in traditional orchards. Although she still wants to see many more, the popularity of urban orchard planting continues to amaze Little, who often sees hundreds of volunteers showing up on planting days. We really believe that community orchards can transform people's lives, she says. They change how we eat, help nature, give us an opportunity to come together and provide a shared purpose. In January, Little will be hosting a wassail, an event where people gather to pour cider on trees, sing, and ward off evil spirits. You're blessing the trees for the season to come, she says. There can be a procession and a parade. It's about bringing people together. Not to get too philosophical, we're facing so many crises at the moment, we have to use our imagination and our creativity. Little sees it as the perfect antidote to climate doom. If we imagine a dark future, it's really not motivating. There's something about community orchards. Sometimes people don't even come because of the fruit trees. They come because they're lonely. Orchards are climate change resilient and help fight isolation and loneliness. There's nothing quite like dancing under apple trees in the middle of winter, summoning fruit, joy, and a ripe harvest to combat your ecological doom. See you at the wassail. Tips for a thriving orchard is a sidebar. Underplant the fruit trees. Perennial herbs attract pollinators. Also include ground cover plants and nitrogen fixers. Comfrey, rhubarb, chamomile, lavender, and thyme are all excellent companions, says Little. Then you can add plants for fun. Throw in some alliums for a pop of color, maybe some ornamental plants. Avoid chemicals. Apples are included in the Dirty Dozen list, a roundup of the most sprayed fruits we eat. If you're growing your own, the best way to avoid pests and diseases is to go for diversity in your planting and aim for a balanced ecosystem. Plant in the winter. From November, bare root options are available. By planting bare root trees, you'll be giving your orchard a better start in life, and they're usually less expensive than buying container-grown plants at other times of the year. Shop at organic nurseries. Look for local organic growers for your stock rather than using more general online retailers. That way you'll find more interesting varieties, perhaps ones that were grown historically in your area. And finally, grow a variety of different fruits or even nuts. Having diversity within your orchard is good, naturally. For the best yields, your apples, for instance, will need pollination from different cultivars that flower at the same time. Also, if you don't fancy apples or pears, look at planting a nuttery. Hazel and walnuts are both good options to try in a UK garden. An article by Tabby Jackson G, published on September 15, 2023, in the Financial Times, How to Grow Your Own Orchard. That wraps up episode 333 of Green and Growing in the Garden, weekly gardening program designed and produced for the Los Angeles Radio Reading Service. Please send your comments at www.larrs.org or email us at oneword laradioreading@gmail.com. Give us suggestions of gardens or stories to follow, your thoughts on a favorite story you heard, or what you think about the broadcast itself. Gardens are not just plants, soil, and irrigation. They speak to us of the world around us even as we try to create order or impose structure. They connect us to our landscape and to the cycles of nature. They teach us patience, stewardship, and fortitude. They offer possibilities of beauty, of persistence, sometimes even of transcendence. And they open our senses to both the heart and the soul, to being alive, to being connected with other gardens, other gardeners, and other times. Whether in a container or in pots on a balcony in the city, in a defined, dedicated garden area, planted around a suburban house or in an urban courtyard, or in spaces surrounded by trees, landscape, and open sky, gardens are precious indeed, no matter where they are. I'm Hugh Rolston, your host. Thanks for joining us. Until the next time.